Apologize, as you may know, this is the last week of our semester here, and I couldn't attend your sessions. I heard they were wonderful yesterday and this morning. When the organizers asked me to comment on Chaim Chazan's paper, and Chagai can attest to it, my first response was, you know, he's like King Solomon of Israeli academia, he's the wisest among men. What do I have to say? What would I have to say? And another parallel, as you just heard, with King Solomon is his beautiful poetic way of presenting complex ideas. Yeah, right. No, not in your case. I hate bad writing, but yours is complex and good. You know, I'm also grateful that with a parallel to King Solomon, you don't share other qualities like fencing, bathing women that are married to other men. So we won't push this analogy to... As we heard, Chazan maps tensions in two models or general outlooks about age, universality versus diversity, determinacy versus indeterminacy, social time versus the experience, course versus... What was great about this paper for me was that although one may think, you know, this is a sociologist in a Tel Aviv department, of course he would take the post-structuralist side of things. No, he problematizes it. He shows how there are unintended consequences and paradoxes where it's sometimes the essentialist way of understanding all age that permits great freedom of, you know, just doing what the hell they want and pursuing things that they couldn't have pursued as responsible citizens and parents that were supposed to, you know, put bread on the table and plan for their pension, etc., etc. So all I can do is to try and offer ways in which great rich mapping resonates with my work as a legal scholar, and I hope it would be helpful in thinking about those issues. So I'll mention three points, and they will move from the more general to the particular. All three points, I think, will help doing what Chaim tried to do or did very well, which is to show that there is no one outlook that is definitely better than the other. In different contexts, legal contexts, they work differently. And I also would like to premise what I say stress that it's I'm talking on the level of political or normative usefulness. Sorry for this instrumentalist word, of each model. So how, as lawyers, we can turn when we need to and we want to promote whatever justice, I'm sorry for this big word, get better results, help prevent discrimination or increase liberty. And sometimes we would rely on one model and other times we would rely on the other model. So the first point is the tension between particularized namings of identities and universalism in anti-discrimination law. So let's take an example. You know, we read the wonderful opening phrase of the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Declaration of Independence. We hold this truth to be self-evident that all men were born free and equal. And it's a, you know, glorious moment of wonderful constitutional system of human rights. And then, you know, a few decades elapse and women campaign for voting rights. And they say, no. Or black people campaign for voting rights. And they tell, no, we hold this men, i.e. white men. Okay? So this is the point where anti-discrimination theory says, okay, we know that when they said men, this should be interpreted as universalist, all-encompassing all humanity, but it doesn't work. So we need to write anti-discrimination laws, such as Title VII in the American context or the Equal Opportunity Law in Israel, and name specific groups that should be included in this vision of equality. But that creates a paradox, because when you read Title VII, or when you read the Israeli law, it can read as liberating all those groups. It's a very progressive document, because in Israel, for example, you not only have employers shouldn't discriminate people on the basis of race, gender, nationality, religion, you also have women that are undergoing fertility treatments, or women that are undergoing adoption treatments, or people that didn't make it into the military because of their physical state. So, you know, it's a really great vision of encompassing equality. Another way of reading it is, hey, this is a really good manual for employers who want to know who they should worry about as a potential employee, right? So, you know, if it says, thou shalt not discriminate pregnant women, you know, it makes them think, okay, so why shouldn't they discriminate? Pregnant women are, you know, not as committed to the workplace. I'm going to lose them as when they're mothers, and I'm going to lose them for maternity leave. So that's a complexity we encompass. Here is another example, a case from the U.S. where a Mexican cross-dresser asked for asylum in the U.S., and the first instance in the lower court said, look, you're a cross-dresser, just change your dress and they will stop persecuting you in Mexico. Now, the only way he could win finally in the circuit court is when he brought an expert opinion, a medical expert opinion that said he was suffering from dysmorphic sexual whatever, blah, 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 blah. There was a title in the DSM. So now we have a fixed biological clinical category, and that makes his way through the court. So the point is, if you want to succeed in an anti-discrimination claim, you better argue according to the first fixated model. There's zero tolerance for complexity, for fluid identities, for fragmented identities, for pushing the boundaries, etc., etc. An example from my own research, people that are discriminated because of their physical weight, because they're fat. Non-PC word consciously, I'll explain why if you want later. The only way that they can win in American courts is if they show that this is a matter of, they have the fat gene, or they have some condition, you know, that forbids them from. You cannot say, you know, I'm fat and I'm beautiful, I'm fat and I'm proud. I won't go into your like medical moral panic about obesity. I refused. I make a choice. This is about my autonomy, about body size. This will not fly. Okay. Finally, but with the first point, there's the issue of age-based discrimination, which is also forbidden in many countries, in the U.S. Here, in some pieces of legislation, it says specifically, this is only about old age. We only protect people that are considered too old. In others, it doesn't say that, so young people can come and say, I was considered too young to be, whatever, a bank manager, and they can also be protected. But they, again, need to stress their biological age and to show, let's say if it's an old person, the plaintiff, they have to show that a younger, biologically, chronologically younger person was chosen for the job, okay? Now, there is hope. Okay. there is hope there because we're moving in anti-discrimination theory to this sociologically... Okay, sociologically based understanding of age or of other categories of identity, when we begin to understand that, you know, age is what age does. They said it about race. Race, we know that it's not genetically based, sociologically, you know, screwing up people because of stigma. So now we're getting into a phase that I think that American courts and Israeli courts will start saying, okay, even though you are younger than the person that was selected to the job, you were perceived as older. Right? So some people are the same age or different age, but you were perceived as older, and therefore we will. This whole issue of the sociology of age, how it's acting in the world, is helpful here, and I think will develop further. My second example is from Israeli courts' understanding of time of emergency. So as you may know, Israel from 1948 is laws, it declares that it's a country in a state of emergency, which allows the government many powers to deny human rights. So let's say not just, you know, demolishing house of Palestinians, but even mundane issues. For example, if people like doctors want to go on a strike, labor unions, the government can tell them, no, this is a state of emergency, okay? So you can't do that. That's now the narrative. If you read cases, the what comes out of it is first that the judges take this omniscient view from nowhere. They look at the national time, the national axis of time. The axis of time is very modernist. It's getting better all the time, like the Beatles. And they know to say, let's say if it's a temporal crisis, like the Intifada, the second Intifada started with, in 2000, started with riots within Israel proper of Palestinians or citizens of Israel, and they were put in remand, like put in under arrest in masses, tens of them. Now they wanted to get out of, because they said, you know, criminal law doesn't permit you to put me in jail. I'm not dangerous, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I only participated in a vigil, you know, about national causes. And the courts, decided those cases according to their reading of has down. Are can we now move on and say, okay, things are relaxing, or are we still in this turmoil? Exactly, it's the same. Exactly, it's the same thing. Third and final point. This year, I served on a governmental bioethics committee. This is the report of the committee. I have a copy here to see if this university, and if you want to read it, it's in Hebrew. And the question that we were asked to decide upon is whether it is legal and ethical to use age as an excluding factor from the wait list for organ donations. So the situation, different organs have different age, but let's say you arrived at the age of 67, you're waiting on a liver or on a heart transplantation, you are pushed out because you became too old for the list. Now, we had long debates, and after all those debates, we decided to disqualify age itself as a standalone criterion from the, you know, how to prioritize the consideration, how to prioritize between the patients. There was a minority opinion, a dissenting opinion, and this minority opinion really reflects Chaim's mapping, you know, the first part, the essentialist fixated the universal part of his mapping, because people said, you know, let's say we have two patients, one is 25 years old, one is 60 years old, all other things being equal, they have the same blood type, they have the same medical condition, none of them would die if he doesn't get the liver now. We think that the 25 year old should get the, because why? Because the 60-year-old had more years of life, okay? I thought this was a wrong approach from two reasons. One is the you know, the slippery slope argument. We're going to get into utilitarian considerations. Let's say that the 60-year-old has five people depending on them financially, and the 25-year-old doesn't. So maybe we should privilege the 60. Let's say the 60-year-old is a scientist on the verge of discovering the cure for Alzheimer's disease, right? Why not take this into the consideration? But the other reason I thought this was problematic is exactly because of what Chaim has been arguing through his scholarship, which is that, and I know it sounds counterintuitive, and I'm curious what Chaim would think about it. He could be 25, but already have climbed the Everest, a true love, I don't know, write the best. And the 60-year-old is, I'm just saying that, but the 60-year-old, let's say the 60-year-old is only... Right, but this is, you know, these are examples of philosophers that are not grounded, so we do the ideal type extreme. A 60-year-old, let's say they were like, whatever, personnel in the university, it's only when they arrived at 60, they won the lottery and finally they can travel the world. The fact that they're like quantitative number value there doesn't the quality of life of the... What we also said in the committee, which brings up the biological or chronological age, kind of lurking through the back, we recommended that doctors will decide only on medical criteria. The people in this room know that this is, you know, objective medical criteria. It's all about people that judge other people with all their biases and stereotypes, etc. There is, I think, relatively new, not that new, but a concept of the frailty index. It's a kind of a holistic measure that doctors can use in order to decide whether a person is viable, whether they'll survive the transplantation, how many years are there expected. And there, of course, my hope is that the biological age won't be too powerful in the considerations, but, you know, you don't know. I also hope that gender or social plus one part of the consideration, but I can't guarantee. Finally, the point you made, Chaim, about living in the present is a point that it really resonated with me, because when I see sociological accounts of how fat people to walk through life, I see this sense of limbo, this sense of suspense. They're living in the future, in the imagined future. You know, there's a thin person waiting to come out, and only then will I date and will I aspire to high achievements in my career, etc., etc. And so I see the benefit of living in the now also for, you know, the group that I investigate. So I hope I demonstrated that, you know, the complexity and the fact that there's no right or wrong model, but they work in different contexts.
Okay, thank you so much.